fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor, opposed to the way the world really is. While indigenous people understand the world is consisting of other beings with whom we can enter into relationship, he argues, Westerners believe the world consists merely of objects or resources to be exploited or used.
So I don't know if this is addressing any of the issues you wanted to address.
No, absolutely.
Those are just some of my first responses to the difficulties of maintaining. Well, there's another thing I want to say, which is, it's really, I don't know how you get people interested in important topics. Wow. I just don't know. I've written 20-some books, and I still have no clue. I've done hundreds of talks, and I still have no clue. I mean, I know that there's the Oscar Wilde line about if you want to talk about something serious, you got to make, or if you want to tell the truth, you have to make people laugh, otherwise they'll kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. So at my old talks, when I used to do tons of talks, man, I was just telling jokes all over the place, anything to keep people interested. And then I don't know. I mean, this breaks my heart every moment of every day. That is not hyperbole. That the world is being killed and we can't even talk about it.
Right.
And we can't talk about these. I mean, you would think that the fact that there are stalwart scientists saying the oceans could be devoid of fish in 35 years, you'd think that we might be able to chat about that sitting in a group for an hour without having to pause to check our iPhones. I think mainstream environmental discourse and mainstream anti-imperialist discourse is functionally discouraging and apathy making.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think it is because you get all these mainstream people all these sort of mainstream liberals, mainstream anti-imperialists, mainstream environmentalists who will tell you what the problem is, and then their solutions are insufficient. And everybody knows they're insufficient, and everybody knows they're lies.
Right.
And that is tremendously discouraging. So you'll see some video, you'll see some movie, and I'm not blaming these people, because Food Inc. was fine, but Food Inc., they talk about how terrible the corporate food system is. That's great, great, great discussion. And then what are their solutions? One of their solutions is to buy a fucking yogurt from Walmart.
Right.
It's like, how did you get there? And you see this all the time that we talk about, or like Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, that he talks about how basically the planet is being killed by global warming, and what are his solutions? Put air in your tires. Seriously, that was one of his solutions.
Right.
And what they are is they are all of those were personal, and so they would take your attention at the last moment away from capitalism, away from civilization, and put it back on you. It's like, well, fuck, I didn't see that coming.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with food. That my solution is I'm supposed to walk into Walmart and buy yogurt.
Right.
That's the solution. Not revolution. Not destroy the whole system. Not even talk about the whole system. And so I think that's tremendously discouraging. I think it's tremendously harmful to discourse. To sort of, and it's if we were designing a system of propaganda, this is what we would do, is we would talk about it and then present false solutions.
Right.
Because if you don't talk about it at all, then people will talk about it because it's happening.
Uh-huh.
But then you can't talk about the real thing. And this is not, I'm not saying this is a conspiracy. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying a couple things. One is, this is how capitalism works, that the people who do those get grants.
Yeah.
And they get funded. And I'm not saying this out of envy or jealousy, because my career has been okay, you know? And that's what I'm saying is this is how capitalism works, is you reward the people who, it's the same thing happens with politics, that the people who get to the top, there is a vetting system that goes on at every step of the way.
Right.
And the people who get to the top are going to be interested in power, and they're going to be serving the system.
The crisis began on the evening of December 18th, 1996. A gala party at the residence of the Japanese ambassador. The 600 guests represented the cream of Lima society.
The dramatic 1997 hostage standoff in Peru. On December 17th, 1996, a group of international diplomats was enjoying a lavish party at the home of the Japanese ambassador in Lima, Peru.
Well, I got a great story about this. So, years and years ago, 1997, there was the MRTA took over the Japanese ambassador's house down in Peru,
mm-hmm.
and I interviewed a member of the MRTA, not somebody in the house, but somebody outside the house.
Oh, wow.
I interviewed him, and it was great. And one of the things he said was great was, I said, what do you want for the people of Peru? He said, we want to be able to grow and distribute our own food. We already know how to do that. We merely need to be allowed to do so. Which is the entire struggle right there.
Right.
Okay, so leaving that aside, then what the interview came down to is basically the best way you can help the MRTA is to stop the United States and to go after capitalism, destroy capitalism in the United States. Okay, so that's all great. And then I call the Nation magazine,
uh-huh.
and I say, hey, I got an interview with an MRTA member. Would you be interested? And I talked to them, and they said, yeah, this is great. This sounds really great. So we're very excited. Tell us more about it. And I have this problem of when I'm talking about social change or art, I have a hard time. I can only be full on. I can only tell the truth that I understand it to be.
Okay.
And I'm not very good at being tactical. And so she says, what's your interview about? And I tell her, and then she says, so what are your conclusions with this? And I said, well, the conclusions are what we really need to do to help the MRTA and everybody else in the non-industrialized nations who are suffering in the colonies, what we need to do is we need to destroy capitalism here in the United States. Hello? And she said, okay, yeah, this is all really interesting. Let me get back to you in a couple minutes. I need to go talk to the board. And then she left. And then she sent me an email like 5 minutes later or 10 minutes later saying, thank you very much, but I don't think we're interested. And the moment that it went was the moment I said, let's bring it home and let's destroy capitalism here.
Right.
And so long as we're talking about brown people and poor brown people in some other country who are giving their lives to fight capitalism, groovy, we can support that. And my point is that's how the vetting system works
mm-hmm.
at every step of the way. And that's partly how capitalism works. And it's also how a dysfunctional society works. A dysfunctional family, too. I love this. The three rules of a dysfunctional family, according to Artie Lang, are rule A is don't, rule A1 is rule A does not exist, and rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. So what this means is that if you want to get funding to do a film on the agricultural system, you can get funding as long as you don't. As long as you don't actually attack the entire system. You can attack the entire system so long as the solutions are still personal consumption, still minor changes.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens everywhere. And something has happened that's absolutely extraordinary in the environmental movement in the last 15 years, which is, okay, you get 100,000 people marching in the streets of Paris, or however many you are marching.
Right.
Okay, you ask those people, why are you marching? And they say, we want to save the planet.
Right.
Okay. If you ask them, okay, what are your demands? So many of the demands are, we want federal subsidies for the solar industry because we need to phase out fossil fuels. It's like, did you see what just happened? What social movement have you ever heard of in the past that was able to be turned en masse into a lobbying arm of a specific sector of the industrial economy?
Right.
That is an extraordinary accomplishment. And of course, anybody who's paying attention No, that's entirely insufficient to save the planet. So of course we're not going to feel encouraged, and of course we're not going to want to talk about it, because if you talk about things along the accepted realm, then we all know it's a lie. We all know this is like being in an abusive family and saying, okay, so dad is beating and raping everybody. What are we going to do about it? And then everybody goes, well, maybe if we get a different type of yogurt.
Yes.
Or maybe if we just had solar power on the house, dad wouldn't be beating everybody. It's so incredibly crazy.
I notice it even in conversations with people, just what you're talking about. To me, it's like, recognize the fact that this is happening. It's falling. And let's start there.
Yep.
That one doesn't even seem to want to be on the table with, I can count on one hand how many.
You know, I'm going to have to stop this interview for a second because I got to go check and see how the Broncos-Buccaneers game is going. I mean, that's it, exactly.
Right. You know? I mean, or, you know, what do you do with that? I mean, that's...
Well, actually, what I should do is I should just click on this little thing here, and then I can turn on that other, and I can click back and forth, and I can still keep the conversation while I'm watching what's going on.
Absolutely. We can put the little screens of the news channel and the strips of the things that keep us distracted.
I gotta check Facebook too, see if there's anything exciting happening. Another thing I just want to bring into this is that it cracks me up that, I mean, I'm known for what I write, you know, my environmental mentor is also a doctor, the guy who started me in this 30 years ago, or 25, 28 years ago, whatever. He's also a doctor, and his nickname, among a lot of other people, was Dr. Doom, because, you know, the stuff we talk about is really gloomy. And so I'm known for this, but even having been known for this, even writing Endgame and all this other stuff, I've had so many editors say to me over the years, you know, we want you to write an article for us, and we want you to write about the apocalypse, but then make sure that the end is happy.
Yeah.
And that takes us back to the problem, is like, what is wrong with actually feeling despair?
Right.
And what is wrong with understanding that we are in a desperate situation? And like you just said, that's where we need to start. You know? I'm not saying that, oh, we're in a desperate situation, so let's sit on our fucking hands and don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is, like my doctor friend says, the first step towards cure is proper diagnosis.
Right.
And if you can't diagnose, you know, if my diagnosis is not that I have Crohn's disease, but instead that I have a nervous stomach and I just get diarrhea for some reason or whatever, then we can never actually move towards solving the problem.
Right.
And so for me, one of the important things is to simply attempt to address the problem, which actually doesn't address your let's tie this back to apathy. I think that part of the reason that a lot of people are apathetic, and we are systematically trained to be, systematically trained to care more about, you know, the Michigan Wolverines than real Wolverines.
Mm-hmm.
And or the Detroit Tigers than real Tigers. We're systematically trained to care about that more.
Mm-hmm.
And another part is, once again, like I said, we are, discourse in general, drives us away from discourse because even people who do these good films, they still, at the end, they step back.
Yeah.
It's like there are many things that I love about Richard Heinberg's work. You know, he wrote The Party's Over, for which I will forgive him almost any sin because of that great book. That's
yeah.
A fabulous book. And yet so often, let's take it away from Heinberg. It doesn't matter. But a lot of these peak oil people, they understand that peak oil is passing. A lot of the climate change people will understand that. But then at the last minute, they either fall back into this phony sustainability where they're trying to sustain the culture and not the planet.
Right.
Or they fall back into survivalist mode. And a lot of this brings me back to the notion that So many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing is we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And what I take that to mean, or part of what I take that to mean, is that we need to transfer our loyalty away from the system and to the land.
I'll give an example I find a completely apathetic subject, is that downwinders, I'm sure you know about here from the desert, of bombs exploding in the desert forever, and everybody has cancer from it, and hypothyroid and these different things, there's no going to the corporation saying, hey, you need to pay for the medical costs of these people. It's art installations and these little things to just say, hey, we're doing something about it, but we ain't really doing anything about it. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, in my most recent book, I wrote about a woman in some small community in Utah who's a midwife who happened to notice that there were a lot of babies dying ever since the fracking started in the community.
Oh, wow.
And she, for raising this issue, she received a ton of death threats. She is very... There's even this one woman who had two miscarriages who still was attacking the midwife for bringing this up.
Whew.
And this has to do with that, what we were talking about earlier with the decolonizing, because they're identifying so closely with the system that that this woman actually lost two children, and she still identified with the system more than more than her own blood.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, so God, I don't mean to be discouraging, because I think you're doing a fabulous thing, and you are doing a fabulous thing. It's just that talking about these issues is violating a central rule of capitalism, a central rule of a technologized culture,
mm-hmm.
and a central rule of a dysfunctional system at all.
Mm-hmm.
So you're facing three different... So, you know, when you first brought up the apathy, it's like, that's a question too. Is it apathy, or is it adherence to a dysfunctional system and terror?
Mm-hmm.
Terror of violating that R.D. Lang rule.
Right.
Which manifests as apathy. You know, publishing is collapsing. Book publishing.
Right.
And there are many reasons for this, and one of them has to do with the internet. And one of them has to do with, I was interviewing Ramsey Kanaan, who publishes some of my works. He publishes PM Press. He's a really good guy, really smart. And one of the things he said to me is that part of the reason that the book industry is really going, and this is a mutually reinforcing cycle, is that we are in many ways losing the ability to do long-form thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things I do is I sometimes post excerpts of my work on Facebook, and the excerpt might be a page or two. So it's already extracted from the larger, you know, 400-page book down to a page or two. And when I first started doing this, I had quite a few people say, you know, this is too long. Can you condense this down to like sentences? And I would always respond back saying, no, what I'm trying to do is to help reinforce our ability to do that long-form thinking.
Right.
Because there's a relationship between the collapse of salons and the collapse of long-form thinking in general, and the rise of first television and then the internet.
Right.
But I think the technology has done great harm. I mean, I'm sure you heard this when you were in school too, that contrast the Lincoln-Douglas debates with sort of the current debates. I'm not saying that everything was groovy politically 150 years ago. There were just as many. I mean, Andrew Jackson was an idiot.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And was horrible. And there were, in the 1880s, I believe, one of the election slogans for one of the presidents was another guy had had a child outside of marriage, and so the campaign slogan was, Ma, Ma, where's my pa? So I'm not saying that people weren't still petty and stupid,
yeah.
I find it extraordinary that there would be groups of farmers, and nothing against farmers in this way, but groups of people who did not read many books who would listen to a four-hour debate where the people were making allusions to Greek literature and mythology.
Yeah.
And so I think one more thing, which is that there is I can't cite the studies, but I've read studies about how our spans of attention are, however that is measurable, they are measurably decreasing due to multitasking and the internet.
Oh, absolutely. And Microsoft put on one of our shows a few months back. They say it's less than a goldfish right now.
Interestingly, I just want to mention this about goldfishes in specific. It ends up that goldfishes have a bad reputation. They say they have seconds or something.
Uh-huh.
It ends up interviewed a guy about fish intelligence, and he was saying the goldfish actually can remember things for a year. I do know people who enjoy long-form thinking, and I do know people who enjoy talking about serious things. And unfortunately, there aren't a lot, but there are some, and there are some, in fact, who do that, who don't have, whose long-form thinking doesn't have the sort of masturbatory quality that we sometimes associate with philosophy graduate students. Long have been incredibly important historically.
Yeah.
And discourse, obviously, I believe very deeply in discourse, whether it's, you know, long form of months and months or years in a salon or over 500 pages in a book, I believe that's incredibly important for social. I mean, that's another thing, is that there are books that have saved my life. You know, Neil Everndon's Natural Alien. It's like the book jumped out at me at the library, and that book transformed me. I would not be writing what I am without the validation of that book.
Right.
And the transformation of that book. Joseph Campbell. A long time. And so you have a salon, part of the point of a salon, I would think, would be to get people to walk away going, oh shit, I thought I understood something and now I don't. And then let them do the work.
Right.
You know, but that's really uncomfortable work when we are taught. And school teaches us the opposite of this. What is a test? A test, you have to know what is the answer to this particular question. The point is not to live in that question and to go, gosh, I gotta think my way through this. You don't get points for doing that on a test. Everything in school is about specific answers, which is not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is learning the process of actually learning how to think.
Right.
But here's the good news. There is some good news.
Oh, great.
The good news is that process is both scary and fun. For many people. For some people, it's not fun.
Most of the subjects that they usually became relevant were mental illness taking center stage, and their own mental illness. And
I just want to thank you in this current new rising McCarthyism for having the courage to say that. Because, I mean, that actually can be a really interesting discussion too. I mean, I have become convinced that most of our philosophies are simply mental illness taking the center stage on the larger scale.
Mm-hmm.
That is nothing but narcissism, you know, a means of reifying narcissism and sociopathy.
Absolutely.
But on the most personal scale, this is really happening too. And I mean, I've gotten notes over the years because I say that this culture is insane. I say it all the time.
Right.
And I've gotten notes from people saying, you can't say that, that's ableist. Artists, I'm sure you know that there are a lot of fellow artists who are kind of nuts. And that I wondered about that connection for a long time. And what I came to is that, for the most part, artists are people who have been spun out from society and have, we've stepped away from society, and so then we have some perspective to look at it, one hopes. Just Campbell, where he talks about how, for those in whom a local mythology works, there exists a great sense of accord with the universe and of meaning in your life.
Right.
So, for example, if you're a Catholic and you really believe in the whole Catholic tradition, you have a 2,000-year set of meaning presented to you. And you can go get communion, and if it works for you, all is good in the universe.
Okay.
And you have meaning in your life. But if, however, and now I'm back to Campbell, if, however, it doesn't work for you, or if working produces deviant effects, by deviant he meant not the intended effects,
right,
then you will have a hole in your life, and you will need to go search for meaning on your own, which is the hero journey.
Right.
And so if Catholicism doesn't work for you, then you're kind of fucked. Because you have no sense of meaning, and you have this hole in your life, and you need to go out and fill it.
Right.
And you need to find how to plug that void. And that can be a very painful process in which we can go down lots of wrong directions, and we can get killed by monsters. Okay, my mind is going in a few directions, and one of them is that there have been studies done on how students over the last 30, college students over the last 30 years have become remarkably more narcissistic and less empathetic. And the way they did the study was they asked students from, I think, 1980 to 2010, or maybe 1990 to 2010, I don't remember which. They would ask them questions like, do you feel bad when your friend is sad? Or, if your friend is hungry, would you give your friend some food? Whatever.
Okay.
And the students were like 72% less likely to, there's a huge decrease in however they quantified empathy that way. So that was one thing I wanted to mention. Another is, so far as patriotism, and I don't know if we can pull any of these together, so far as patriotism, have you read my book? It's okay if you haven't. The Culture of Make-Believe?
Yes. It's what turned me on to you, my partner. That was my beginnings of understanding it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One of the things I'm pretty pleased with in that book is that I kind of predicted the rise of Donald Trump. Not by name, but basically if you look at the 1920s Germany, you look at 1860s and 70s Deep South, that what you see is when an economy collapses, a lot of times when a capitalist economy collapses, especially, because capitalism is based on competition, and competition becomes more fierce as the economy collapses or as the middle class collapses, oftentimes people will search for scapegoats. Whether it's 1920s Germany searching, scapegoat as the Jews and the Allies, or whether it was, African Americans in the 1870s. And so it's no surprise in many ways that this increased jingoism and xenophobia can come to the fore. I want to say something about music, too, that kind of horrifies me.
Okay.
And that's I was listening to some guy get interviewed a few years ago. He was saying it's so great when rock and roll comes into a new place and then the kids are all dancing to it and you realize that it's because of sort of an archetypal chord progression. Mm-hmm. that there is something that music does that gets right into our body.
Right.
And I think that's great. That's perfect. And that's, I mean, it doesn't matter what's perfect or not because it's how we are.
Yeah, it's a tool.
It's how we've always been.
Right.
But the thing that scares the hell out of me, and I say this as somebody who went to a bazillion concerts in my 20s and 30s and you know, was a UFO forever sort of person.
Okay.
That doesn't alter the fact that it now horrifies me that because some young, very talented, probably drug-addled, late teenagers, people in their early 20s, are able to put together a chord progression that is, that addresses people directly in their body, that suddenly now that opens them up to a message of, you know, I was on my baby and my baby was on me.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. Or opens up to a message of, want to give you every inch of my love.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's horrifying.
It's horrifying.
It's absolutely horrifying.
I was watching a video of an AC/DC concert from a couple of years ago. It's a pretty famous one. It's from, the concert was in Rio de Plata.
Uh-huh.
Huge concert. And, when I read Mumford, Mumford talked about how much he hated rock concerts. And when I read Mumford, I still like rock concerts, and so I was like, hey man, you're coming after something I like. He thought they were he didn't use the word, but a toxic mimic of community and of communal coming together.
Mm-hmm.
I really understood it when I watched this AC/DC concert, when I saw they did a pullback and the entire theater was pulsing to, you know, Back in Black or Highway to Hell or something. And it was horrifying to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the same thing last night. I was at my mom's and we're hanging out, and then I checked the score, football scores, and I wanted to see what was going on in the Louisville Clemson game, and which was between teams who were ranked third and fifth, and it was a very close game. And they did the same thing. They pulled back and showed the audience, and the whole audience is just pulsing as one. This is like, you know, 80,000 people. And and I want to say that when I hear humans, non-humans too sometimes, but when I hear humans singing as a group, I cannot keep from crying.
Hmm.
I think that, I mean, just silly old Pete Seeger, Pete Seeger's great, but Pete Seeger sing-alongs.
Like,
I don't care how crappy it is. I don't care how corny the song is. Give me that old-time religion, I can't stop crying. Because that's what music is supposed to do for us, is to bring us together.
Right.
It's supposed to be this communal act of bundling of the community. And, I cannot keep from crying from, Beethoven's Ninth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It just gets me viscerally. And literally viscerally. And so those two things with the AC/DC or last night with the Louisville Clemson game, it's like, mm-hmm. I don't even know what to make of this. It's just, I mean, I rambled on to say the same thing you said for in one word, which is horrifying.
It is. It is horrifying. And it's, there's not a lot to say about it. Sometimes I even wonder why we're still doing music. Just the only thing, even as a musician.
Because music, it's not music. What is happening there is a toxic mimic of this. Music does open people up. Music is different than words because words have to be translated. The thing that terrifies me about the 20-year-olds writing this shit is that it's like a surgeon opening up your body, except they don't know what the hell they're doing.
Right.
And, I mean, frankly, the same thing is true with a lot of writing, except that music is more visceral. You know, music is older. That's why my first book is called The Language Older Than Words. Because music is part of that language, metaphor is part of that language. I remember, gosh, this is 15 years ago. I was My mom had to go. I live in a small town, and basically Walmart has destroyed all the other businesses. So I'm going to say I'm going to go to Walmart, but don't get mad, because it's like, what other choice do you have? It's a company town at this point. So I went to Walmart, and she went in to go shopping, and for whatever reason, I didn't feel like going in with her that day. I felt like sitting outside and reading. So, and there were people on benches that are provided, and I didn't feel like sitting next to anybody, so I sat on the curb and started reading. And it was extraordinary. A lot of the people who walked by would give me dirty looks. And I was, you know, I was dressed nicely, and didn't have unauthorized long hair, and I didn't, you know, have unauthorized, you know, I presumably had shaved within the last 3 days or something. You know, I was like, but I was feeling this old, but they were giving me dirty looks because I was not sitting in an authorized place. And the point here is that I felt this overwhelming urge to go sit in the proper place, even though people I didn't know were basically giving me dirty looks and going on. And my point on that is just how it's so true that we are social creatures.
Yeah.
And just that level of disapproval can influence us pretty heavily about something that is so trivial as where I'm sitting. And that's number two. Number three is, I remember reading about this experiment a few years ago where I think it was called something like the second voice, or the second person experiment.
Okay.
Where they had people sitting in a waiting room, and then one person who was part of the experiment would say some offensive opinion. Like they would make, you know, a disparaging comment about Mexican Americans or something. I don't remember what it was. And what they found is the response of everybody else in the room was really heavily influenced by the second voice. So it would be another person in the room who was in on the experiment. And if that person, like, if, let's say it was a joke about Mexican Americans, and if the second person laughed and said, hey, that's a good one, everybody else in the room would be more likely to go along with further comments like that. But if the second person said, you know, that's not really cool, I don't really like jokes about Mexican Americans that way, then everybody else in the room would go along with that second voice. And just how heavily influenced we can be by that. I have a friend who, a couple friends who work for this great organization called Buffalo Field Campaign.
Okay.
And one of the founders of the organization told them when they started the organization, she said, you know, about 5% of our work is going to be actually doing work for Buffalo, and 95% is going to be dealing with basically drama among group interactions and kind of, you know, bullshit. And
right.
What the term I often use is flak from, you know, the anti-aircraft.
Right. You know, exactly.
This stuff keeps you from getting to the target. Just this bullshit.
Static.
It happens in families too. It happens everywhere where it's so easy to get, to not be able to get to your point because there can be all these interpersonal interactions. I don't like this person, and then that person says something, and then I get in a snit, and there can be all this weird stuff. Okay, that's another level. So many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And what I take that to mean, or part of what I take that to mean, is that we need to transfer our loyalty away from the system and to the land.
Yeah.
Okay, but I'm going to bring up something else about apathy too, and a difficulty of a salon in general.
Okay.
And this is not a modern problem. This is a generic problem. But I remember reading a line a long time ago that was, it takes 10 years for someone to change their mind. And the guy who wrote that, he had that observation because he had been staunchly anti-choice, and then about 10 years later he realized he was staunchly pro-choice, and he hadn't noticed the transition.
Huh.
And for me, it hasn't normally taken 10 years, but it has taken a couple years. And a great example of that in my own life is when I first read and then interviewed John Livingston. One of the things he talked about is how evolution is based primarily on cooperation, not on competition. When I first read that, I was thinking, ooh, he's crazy. That's nuts. And then I interviewed him, and I didn't say that to him, basically because that would have been a terrible interview, but I was still thinking, nah, that's crazy. And about 3 years later, I was arguing vociferously for evolution being based on cooperation without having had a trans... So my point is, it almost never happens. You know, you and I disagree on something. It doesn't matter what.
Right.
And it almost never happens that you make an argument and I go, God damn, you're right. And then change. Mm-hmm. Oh, here's another great example. This is a perfect example. When I was in high school, it was common to use the word fag to talk about anybody. It was a generic insult. I would call my friends fag.
Mm-hmm.
And
I remember these days. I grew up in San Francisco. I remember these days very, very well. Okay.
And one day, I was teaching a friend of mine to drive in my car, and he ran my car into a pole. And I said, oh, you fag. And this friend happened to be gay, which I had never actually made the connection. He said, yes, I am a fag, and what does that have to do with me running your car into a pole? And it's like, oh, I get it. This is actually a slur. Uh-huh. I mean, this is something I should not say.
Yeah.
And, okay, so the question is, did I stop saying the word fag the next day? No. It took me about a year.
Okay.
And it took me a year to get that out of my vocabulary, even though I had been told as concisely and clearly as possible that this is an unacceptable word.
Right.
And even with something as obvious as that, it still took me a year. And something as trivial as that compared to, oh, we need to understand that industrial civilization is still on the planet. So my point in bringing this all up, and of course, to be very clear about that, yes, I do recognize it's a slur. Yes, I don't use it, you know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. This is 19 years old, and I thought farts were funny too, you know? When I used to teach, one day there was, I had my students teach the class sometimes, and they would break into groups, they'd figure out what they're going to do. And one time this one group was trying to teach the class, and they had great questions to which nobody was responding. And the guy got frustrated, and he said, what's the matter? Don't you like to think? And we had established enough intimacy and support in the classroom that somebody actually answered honestly. And he said, actually, no, I don't. And the people who were running the class got really frustrated and started going, why don't you? And I said, wait, let me take over. And I took over. I said, this is really interesting to me. So no judgments, just how many of you in class don't like to think about anything? You don't like the process. And about things you like. And about a third of them raised their hands. And it was exactly the third I would have predicted, just from the quality of their writing.
Okay.
And so I said to one guy, look, when you're watching football, do you not think anything? He said, no, I don't. I said, wait a second. So you don't think, gosh, maybe they should have done a draw play instead of, instead of a long pass?
Maybe sure.
That time, maybe they brought in this other player. And he just looked at me blankly and he said, no. And so this one woman in class, I said, well, what do you think about when you're taking a shower? When you're taking a walk? He said, well, I think about how mad I am at my boyfriend. And I go through the last conversation we had and we've all done that where you're just sort of running on a hamster wheel.
Yeah.
But that's what she was doing. So my point is, long point, sorry, but there are some people who are just not going to like thinking. So don't worry
yeah.
about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but there are some people for whom thinking is really fun. I experienced this when I was teaching, that some people for whom thinking is really fun, but it's been pounded out of them through all of their schooling that they're not thinking right, or they're supposed to think to an answer instead of think to things are opening up. I will forgive Faulkner almost everything because of the metaphor in the bear.
Okay.
The story in the bear is everybody's looking for this old bear. I don't know if I'm able to say this without crying. There's a metaphor in the old bear. So everybody's looking for the old bear. Nobody can find the old bear. And everybody wants to see him. Some people want to shoot him. And then the main character in the story goes out looking for the bear. And he doesn't see the bear until he has gotten lost, dropped his gun, and dropped his compass, and dropped his watch. So when he gets rid of his watch, which means he steps out of time, he doesn't worry about time anymore, he loses his compass, he's lost his way completely, and he is defenseless. He has no gun. Then he sees the bear. And that's what we're trying to do, I think.
Large private corporate databases accumulated that accumulate information on individuals. Economic activities. These corporations would call themselves credit corporations or whatever, but they're essentially intelligence operations.
See what you did to my people? See what you did to them? You took their very lives away from them. You better
at the very time they were conducting such an operation against the American Indian Movement, a program directed towards the American Indian Movement, very similar to the program directed against the Black Panther Party.
The same bag of tricks in each case. You have a very concerted disinformation campaign. You have the insertion of infiltrators and the development of informants. The use of the infiltrators as provocateurs, attempting to convert bona fide activists into provocateurs or disruptive elements within their own organization.
They're setting us up.
And I said, well, it's time to define what we do want. And largely that turned out to be permaculture.
As our culture progresses, we find that we gather more and more information, and that we slowly start to move almost from a fluid to a vaporous state as we approach the ultimate complexity of a social boiling point. I believe that our culture is turning to steam.
For Kerry versus Bush, because they're too much alike. What if it was Kerry versus ex-Klansman David Duke?
That's an easy one. Obviously, it would be Kerry, but
somebody who could. So, it's, in other words, Bush is just not bad enough.
They both.
I know, but obviously, you'd vote for Kerry over Duke.
So, why are we restricting ourselves to these choices when we have so many good people in this country that should be running for president and senator and governor?
What will money be given out to people for?
Well, the people would say that.
People in the community.
You need some living room furniture, maybe?
You need a car, maybe?
See, I got the thing is with me, you see, I need to know.
You say no to everything that you're doing here, especially to the government that's come to come and speak to the elected chiefs in council of this area.
You've been educated to hate the enemy, but I'm your brother. I helped you lead the revolution. Now I'm more pressure. Another example, Papa Doc in Haiti. Papa Doc in Haiti hated everything white. Man, you couldn't put this white paper in front of Papa Doc's face. But he moved all the white people out, and he took over and be oppressed when he did, causing no education. And the people that have been educated, they just said that we don't hate the motherfucker white people. We hate the oppressor, whether he be white, black, brown, or yellow. So we got to know your educational program to find out what is going to be in the finale. A lot of people, what Jomo Kenyatta is called not a mesorevolutionary, but an ex-revolutionary.
But what they're doing is they're getting that bill, they're getting the passport ruling, for example, They're getting the other legal precedents, such as the lawsuit against Frank Snepp, Marchetti, and myself, and travel restrictions. They're getting authority for the Secretary of State to throw people out of the country who should have political exile here, such as the El Salvadorian refugees. And they're getting these things ready so that the next war that they get us into, as in Vietnam, they will have the legal power, muscle, to handle it differently than they did during the Vietnam War.
To handle dissent at home, to make it impossible to speak out.
The dissent that choked off Kissinger's and Nixon's and before that Rusk's efforts in Vietnam, the popular uprising at home that forced the United States government to abandon its policies and plans in Vietnam, will not be nearly, the government will have weapons to crush such a thing in the future. It'll have an Official Secrets Act to make it illegal to publish stories like My Lai and whatnot, because there were obviously secret agents involved. So the publication of the My Lai stories would be a felony.
Beauty right now and things that are not so popular in the sense of...
Our system reconstructs and tracks both source and target actors using a dense photometric energy minimization. Using a novel subspace deformation transfer technique, we transfer the expressions from the source to the target actor. This allows us to obtain a modified face template of the target actor according to the expressions of the source actor.
So
we now re-render the modified face on top
of...
So kick Sal Paul, for 2 years we've been holding him up, waiting for you to come. Hell, well, now you're here with us.
Oh, hi.
Yes, sir. Don't forget your yogurt.
Oh, my yogurt.
That tastes like shit.
Is, in addition to talking, given all the constraints that are there now that weren't there in prior to the Spanish Civil War, you know, with all the salons that the Spanish anarchists were in, or prior to the French Revolution, given that we have these new constraints, how do you make it even more inviting?
You're asking me.
Yes.